May it please the Court, this is an appeal from a Superior Court decision reversing a decision of the Delaware Human Relations Commission finding the respondents Carmike Theaters and the manager of its Dover Theater violated the Delaware Equal Accommodations Law in the treatment of complainants. The complainants, who are my clients, are 23 African Americans who were patrons of the theater in the night in question. As your honors know better than I do, that the questions on an appeal such as this are whether or not there is substantial evidence to support the findings of the commission and whether or not the commission made an error of law.
What does the record show as to how many persons were in the theater for that particular movie?
The testimony is that there were approximately 130 in the theater. It's not precise, but the theater apparently held 150, and I think it was the manager from Carmike said it was about 90% full, which they call sold out. So there were about 130. They make some comments in their papers about only a quarter of the people in the theater are complainants. My own view is that a quarter of a group is a pretty large number to be filing claims. But in fact, what happened was after the event occurred.
Well, before you get into that, Mr. Morris, does the record show what percentage or how many of that 130 were minority?
There is one witness who says 95%. There's another witness who says everybody. There's another witness who says almost everybody. So those are the three pieces of testimony.
What did the commission? Is there a finding by the commission?
There was a finding that all of the complainants were people of color, but I don't remember the commission making a finding on that point.
So we don't really know. I mean, we have no established fact as to how many of the total number in the theater were minority and how many were not.
I would have to check the commission's decision. They do refer to it as the commission in its decision refers to it as a minority audience. When they are addressing the court, I'll check the opinion and see if I can find something more specific in there. The two facts that the commission found that are at the center of this case are stated in its decision. One is that while complainants were permitted to watch the movie, the circumstances under which they were permitted to watch that movie were hostile, humiliating, and demeaning. While they were allowed to see the movie, they received services in a markedly hostile manner and in a manner which a reasonable person would find objectively unreasonable. So that was one fact finding that's central. And then the second fact finding is that the complainants and everyone in the audience was subjected to that treatment because of their race. The commission said, referring to the manager, he made the announcement at Why Did I Get Married, the movie, because it was a minority movie. The panel finds no credible evidence that respondents had a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for making this announcement at this movie. Those two facts, of course, must be accepted by this court in its role as a reviewing court if they're supported by substantial evidence. I want to start from those facts, and I'll get to the supporting evidence in a moment, but just first starting from those facts, I want to address why it's clear that the commission did not commit legal error and why this case is as important as it is.
All right, but before you do that,
yeah.
What is the leading case that's analogous to these facts that supports your position?
Analogous to these facts? I haven't found a case on point either way, either opposing our position or supporting our position. I mean, there's lots of
I read all the cases that people cited, but I mean, not only in Delaware, but anywhere in the United States, do you have something with similar facts that supports your position?
If you're speaking as narrow as movie theaters now.
No, I'm speaking as narrow as, I guess, to use the way your brief describes it, this, the tone, the tenor of the announcement was offensive. Is that correct?
That is correct, but that's a small piece of the supporting evidence.
All right. Give me the other piece.
Okay. The other piece, the pieces are, to begin with, when the audience, when the African-American audience walked into their theater, or went to get to their theater, having already shown tickets at the door, as everyone does, to get into.
Right, and they had to show them to a security
guard. Had to
show
the security guard second time. It never happened with any other audience. There are people who have been to 100 movies at this theater with a mixed audiences. They were never asked to do that.
Right. So, and I don't want to take up your time with my question, because we've read the facts and we understand. That's why my question is, having read your brief and read the cases, what's the best case that supports your legal argument?
Well, certainly our legal argument is supported by the legal discussion in the Hatfield Seafoods case came out different, that this court affirmed. It came out differently because the facts were different. But the legal principles that we rely on are all in the Hatfield Seafood case.
Okay. Thank you.
What are the precise legal issues that we have to decide?
Okay. The overriding sort of legal issue is, again, accepting these facts, is whether or not the Delaware Equal Accommodations Statute permits a business to treat its African-American or other minority customers in a way that, in order to receive the services or product that that business sells, the business may say, may treat them in a hostile, demeaning, humiliating manner. That's the overall legal question.
Isn't that a loaded question? I mean, is that really the legal question that we have to decide?
I think, as applied, yes. Now, you take one step down, the legal question is, when the deal statute says that no person operating a, in essence, public establishment may directly or indirectly deprive a customer of any of the advantages or privileges of the institute, of the business, does it really mean any of the advantages and privileges?
Well, so far you've given me two issues, but neither of them addresses the decision by the Superior Court. You have to be arguing, or else you wouldn't be here, that there was legal error. What is the legal error?
Oh, by the Superior Court?
Yes.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I was jumping over that because this review is de novo. The reason, I think the Superior Court decision is wrong because, in essence, it made two errors. The first error that it made was it looked at the commission's decision and it said, well, the commission looked at the hostility in deciding that the second element of a prima facie case had been proven. The second element is whether or not there's been some deprivation of service. The commission looked at the hostility to find that. What Judge Vaughn said was that was an error by the commission because you can only look at hostility to prove the third element, namely the element that minorities are treated less well than others. So he said that the commission erred because it used hostility when thinking about the second better than the third.
Second element being what?
The second element is that there has been, and I use different phrases for it, either a deprivation of service or a denial of access. And he said the commission cannot consider the hostility and the demeaning conduct, et cetera, as showing that there was a.
He said that hostility can only be used to prove the third element, which is what?
The third element is that non-members of the protected class are treated more better than members of the protected class. So he said it can't be used, can only be used for the third. His reason for saying it can only be used for the third was to say, well, Judge Jordan in the Hatfield case used it for the third, so that means it can't be used for the second.
Okay, so one of the issues is whether that was a correct reading of the law.
Yes.
Okay, are there any other issues?
The other issue is his statement that, in essence, he said that the complainants cited no case where a rude statement was actionable under an equal accommodation statute. And that it was also error because it really addresses the wrong question. Yes?
Reversible error? I mean, the what I'm really trying to ask is, what is it that we need to decide, in your view, in order for your side to prevail?
Oh.
I understand the first issue as you presented it. Are there any others of that dimension?
Well, again, as I read his opinion, he ruled against us for two reasons. One was the one that I guess I've explained clearly enough, and the second one I guess I haven't explained clearly enough. And the second one was he said that, in essence, rather than paraphrase, let me read his own language. He said, I'm not persuaded that the making of the announcement in this case, although done in a condescending and humiliating tone and in the presence of security officers, constituted a denial of access. And he sort of supported that by observing that we hadn't cited a case where just a rude comment was enough. So what Judge Vaughn is saying is making a condescending and humiliating address in the presence of security officers to the customers cannot be a violation of deal. So that's the second.
You mean in and of itself?
Couldn't have been in this case. And since he didn't dispute or find any fault with the commission's finding that this whole thing was racially motivated, then I think the fair reading of what he said is even where it's racially motivated, a condescending and humiliating treatment of your customers is not actionable under deal.
He said even if it's racially motivated?
Well, again, that's not in what he quoted, but one of the commission findings was that this whole thing was racially motivated. I don't believe there's any place in Judge Vaughn's opinion where he takes issue with that. And I infer from that he was assuming that was the case when he wrote the sentence.
Okay, let me just make sure I've got it. The second issue is whether a condescending, demeaning statement or announcement without more can be a violation of the statute in this case. If that's not a correct statement.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that. I'm not arguing that a condescending and humiliating statement is actionable unless it's motivated by racial bias. I mean, that's a key element of the statute. The statute doesn't regulate conduct. The statute doesn't say you have to be polite. It just says you have to be equally polite to minorities and non-minorities. If a storekeeper is rude to everybody, that doesn't create, an actionable claim. But as in here, where it was the demeaning treatment only went to the African-American audience, not to any of the other audiences, that's actionable. That's the key, that there has to be bias.
But the proof of bias here, or at least the case for bias, as I understand it, is the finding of the commission that there's no credible evidence that there was any other motive, as opposed to affirmative evidence of bias.
Well, and certainly no one said they were biased, but there's lots of evidence from which one can infer bias. And the cases are clear that, you know, it is, the Delaware cases, there's one cited in the brief that, you know, notes that bias may be inferred from the circumstances.
Right. They can be inferred from the finding of the commission that there's no credible evidence of any other motive.
Now, inferred, that's when Johnson inferred from, the commission found bias because it looked at all these facts, that they only did this with the African-American audience, not with the white audience. The facts are that this was the 10th biggest movie of the year, but the only one where they did this. Why didn't they do it for the other nine? That the evidence is that half the movies, they do 50 movies a day, half of them are sold out. So presumably that was going on for the whole 4 months this manager was there. This is the only time he ever did it except for one teenage movie. He said, well, the fact that I do it a lot is shown by the teenage movie, and it has nothing to do with my viewing the particular audience. But he also said that I did it with the teenage movie. It was a good movie to do that because teenagers cause trouble.
Mr. Morris, the time you've reserved. Unless, you can continue.
Unless your honors have questions, I'm going to sit down.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Matt Niederman for the respondents below and appellees. Also with me at council table is Richard Jarakitis of the Trout & Sanders firm in Atlanta. Your Honors, this case is one about a social and an awkward social interaction between members of different classes, but it's one where the interaction was actually intended to enhance the experience, the social experience at issue. And it's one where it was subjectively perceived by some, but not all members of a protected class, to have been delivered in a demeaning manner. This case arises under the Delaware Public Accommodation Equal Accommodations Law, Section 4504 of Title VI of the Delaware Code, which prohibits the denial of any public accommodation.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Morris. Does the record show what percentage or what number of persons in the theater when this event took place who were non-minority?
I believe it does, Your Honor. Two witnesses, one complainant actually testified, and it was Ms. Burke, that the audience was about 95% African-American. And also one of the witnesses, I think the theater manager for the respondents, testified the same. My friend is correct. One of the complainants did testify that he thought the audience was all color. Before addressing the kind of legal framework that we've been discussing, I wanted to back up and review, if I could, just a couple of the facts that are actually taken from the panel's findings and that I believe are undisputed because I think they bear heavily on the decision in this case. This case, of course, stems from the announcement made at the night of a showing of Why Did I Get Married? In Dover here. It's undisputed that on the night the announcement was made, that showing of the movie was in such demand that it was so sold that the theater manager, who's actually a respondent in this case, made the decision to open up two more screens to show the same movie in. In other words, contrary to a denial of a public accommodation, this manager, who's been accused of kind of doing something racial, when he saw the ticket sales, opened up two more screens to accommodate more members of the public interested in the movie.
And are we supposed to infer from that the additional people waiting to see the movie were also African-American?
I think the testimony was actually from the complainants, Your Honor, that the movie, and I think the panel's finding was that the movie appealed primarily to an African-American audience, but that there could have been members of both of different races in the movie that night.
Okay, but what I'm trying to get clear on is that you're suggesting that the theater manager, far from being hostile to African Americans, was so happy to see the movie filled up and an overflow that he opened up two more screens. And I'm asking, are we to infer, or does the record tell us, that those additional screens were also largely African-American viewers.
I don't believe that's in the record, Your Honor. I think the closest thing in the record is that one of the complainants testified that people that she was with who were also members of the protected class went into another one of the theaters.
Mr. Niederman, I asked Mr. Morris, and I'm going to ask you also, what are the dispositive issues in the case? Mr. Morris identified two. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with his statement of the issues?
I think those two are largely the dispositive issues. I think in terms of the framework where we got to and what the decision was at the court below, the court addressed only the prima facie case and then only got to the second prong of the prima facie case and didn't get beyond that, didn't reach past that because he decided it based on the second element of the prima facie case. And I think on that second element, the two issues would be, number one, number one, was there a conflation? Was there a legal error when the markedly hostile element was applied to the second prong of the test? And number two, can as a matter of law an announcement of this type be a denial of a public accommodation? I think those are the two dispositive issues at this level, Your Honor.
Are we bound? Two questions. Was there a finding by the commission that the announcement was racially motivated? And secondly, if there was such a finding, are we bound by it?
I don't believe that. Well, the panel found a prima facie case and said that there was no evidence of a non-discriminatory purpose. That finding was made in a couple of paragraphs, about 8 or 9 sentences, and was conclusory. Basically just said there was no evidence. In the same part, the panel actually found that the same announcement had been made previously, and it was a finding
in
another movie.
And I'm asking you, I mean, that's sort of a negative way to get to the same bottom line. That is, if there's no credible evidence of any legitimate reason for the announcement, I would think that one has to infer that the only reason for the announcement would be racial bias. Is that a binding?
I don't think that's binding. Well, I think it would be reviewed under the substantial evidence standard, Your Honor. I think there would have to be substantial evidence to support that finding, and obviously we would dispute that there is substantial evidence. Some of the facts that I think are also important here, Your Honors, is that it's not disputed that the announcement that was made, the same announcement, the words had appeared previously on the screen. One of the complainants actually testified that when she saw the words on the screen, she understood that was for the benefit of the members of the audience. The same words were said in the announcement. There's no dispute that the words were not racially charged or that there were any racist comments as part of the announcement. After Mr. Stewart left the theater, he actually was approached by a couple of the people in the audience and was advised that some of the people in the audience were offended. He then returned, apologized, explained that he didn't mean to offend anybody, and then after the movie ended, he actually stood outside the doors to thank people and greet them as they left.
What is the legal significance of that fact?
I think it shows that the subjective nature of what we're talking about here. At the end of the day,
that there was no actual intent to be offensive.
There was no intent to be offensive, and also that at the end of the day, what we're talking about is a subjective perception of an event, and that different people perceived it differently. The manager didn't perceive it as being offensive until somebody approached him and told him it was, upon which he immediately apologized and explained why he had done it. Members of the same audience obviously perceived the same event differently.
That was the part of the factual case that was made by respondent, Carmack. It was rejected on credibility grounds, was it not?
The apology? Or I'm sorry? Which part, Your Honor, I'm sorry?
Well, I understood was it Mr. Stewart?
Yes.
That his testimony was rejected on credibility grounds.
Some of his testimony was. And I think that's one of the problems with the decision from the panel, is that it's hard to draw a correlation between the statement about lacking credibility and any of the actual findings that are written in the opinion?
Well, we're not here to make findings of fact. We certainly can review them, but The question is there a finding of fact to which your comment about the apology is relevant?
I don't know if there's a finding.
Well, how do we take it into consideration now that we have a record and fact findings, whatever they may be, by the commission?
Yeah, I think that is part of the facts in the record. That was a fact actually found by the panel. I think that it just goes, the point of that is it goes to the subjective perception of the events. And another fact that I think that is important there. Yes, sir.
Is it your position that there can be no violation of the Equal Accommodation Statute unless there's something more than what is a subjective response to the way people are being treated?
Yeah, just a subjective perception of a non-racially charged social interaction without more, it would be our position, yeah, that can't be a violation of the Equal Accommodations Law. And, in fact, I think the cases have been very careful to guard against that and say if we have every rude or awkward interaction turn into a violation of the Equal Accommodations Law, then we've broadened it too far. Then you can't have normal social human interaction without running afoul of the laws. So,
well, what I'm trying to pinpoint, if I can, is on the one hand, you can be rude to whoever you want to be rude to, and that's not going to constitute a violation, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
On the other hand, if you're rude to an audience that's almost entirely African-American, and you're not, you don't have a history of being rude to other people at other showings, does that still constitute a non-actionable, he's a rude guy kind of thing?
And I think that goes to the second question that Judge Vaughn addressed, which is can just an announcement without more as a matter of law be a denial of an accommodation? I would say that you would have to leave room for the possibility that that could happen, Your Honor. I think you could probably think up some extreme set of facts where an announcement, something that's just rude and nothing more, would rise to such a level that it might constitute a denial of an accommodation. I think you'd have to come up with a very extreme set of facts, and frankly, I think this just isn't the case. But yes, I think there is the possibility exists that you could have from something rude, depending on why it was rude or how rude it was, that rose to that level. But again, I think there's no case law suggesting that anything like this or analogous ever rose to the level of a denial of a public accommodation. And there's also, I think, two important points as we talk about the second prong of the analysis and the third prong of the analysis, Your Honors, which is the markedly hostile test. It's important to remember that comes sort of at the very end. This was applied in the second prong here. To talk about motivation or to talk about disparate treatment, you'd first have to find a denial of a public accommodation. And markedly hostile was used for that purpose in this case. From there, it's on the complainants to show disparate treatment. And only if there isn't any evidence of how members of the non-protected class and members of the protected class were treated would you get to markedly hostile. In this case, there was, in fact, evidence of how non-members were treated. And evidence comes from the findings of the panel, one of the findings being that a week before, members of a movie whose makeup was not primarily African-American received precisely the same announcement. The evidence also comes from the testimony of one complainant who said that the audience had at least some members of the non-members of the protected class who received precisely the same announcement. It was also an undisputed finding that Mr. Stewart, although he was new to this theater and had just started implementing the live announcement in that theater, had been making it for years at the theater he managed in New York before he was transferred to Delaware. And my friend talked about him not having made the announcement previously. Well, he did make it once previously, but when he arrived in Delaware, he actually first was transferred to Rehoboth to help out with a busy summer season there and spent about a month there, then came back, testified that he was getting used to that theater, getting to know the audience and the customers and getting to know the other workers and how things ran in that theater. And once he was comfortable with that, the first sold-out opening night movie that he had to make the announcement in was Halloween. The following one was Why Did I Get Married? I think another thing that's important to point out here is the two movies where it's undisputed that he made the announcement, the Halloween movie and the Why Did I Get Married, the audience, as described by the findings of the panel, are very different. The Halloween movie was of apparently all races and wasn't primarily any race. The audience of Why Did I Get Married was primarily an African-American audience with some members of a non-minority class. The only similarity...
I'm not sure where you're going with all this.
The only similarity, Your Honor, of the two movies, in other words, the two times we know in this theater this manager made the announcement, the only single factor that ties them together is they were both sold-out first-run movies. That's just not evidence of a denial of a public accommodation. It's evidence of a legitimate purpose for making the announcement. Your Honors asked some questions about whether, as a matter of law, an announcement could rise to the level of a denial of a public accommodation. We would respectfully argue that it cannot. And if there is going to be a case where it can rise to that level, it simply isn't this case. Your Honors also asked about an analogous case. We cited in our briefs what I think is a fairly analogous case, which is the Evergreen case from Washington. That case actually involved sort of a same kind of an awkward social interaction. It was a teacher and students, and a teacher made a statement that was perceived by a particular student, but not other students, as being offensive. It wasn't on its face offensive or racially charged. She was talking about the way somebody had pronounced a word in the class. And the court in Washington found that didn't rise to the level of being a denial of an accommodation. I think when we're talking about denial of an accommodation here, it's also important to contrast this case with the Rouser case. In the Rouser case, where you actually had, in that case, the findings being that the service was being denied to the patron, and I think as it was described by the Superior Court there, the cashier actually said, I'm not going to give you your food unless I get an explanation as to why you got so upset with me, and then slammed the food down and said, go ahead and hit me. And in that case, the court actually said that barely constituted a denial of service, just barely met the threshold of that prong. And I think when you contrast the facts of this case with the facts of that case, it shows that this just doesn't rise to the level as a matter of law of a denial of service. There's also no evidence to show disparate treatment. The only evidence in the record about how other audience members were treated in any other movie.
I assume your point is that if the complainants were offended, so too was everybody else that in that theater that was watching the movie. That there was equal bad treatment rather than disparate bad treatment.
Correct. If it was bad service, it was equally bad service for the members of the audience of that movie, for the members of the audience of the Halloween movie, and for the members of the audiences of the movie theaters in New York and around the country where the same live announcement had been made. At the end of the day, that was why I was making the point about subjective perception. I think a very important point in this case, Your Honors, is that the same announcement was perceived by some members of the protected class in the theater as being offensive. We know that. We also know, and I think an important point is, that two members of the same protected class and a third who was prepared to testify showed up and testified, and these are neutral witnesses by all regards, showed up and testified that they were there, heard precisely the same announcement, and did not in any way perceive it to be rude or demeaning, and in fact were upset by what happened to the theater manager afterwards. We also have evidence from one of the complainants and the manager that some of the members of the audience were not members of the protected class. We also have evidence about the movie in which the announcement had been made the previous week. I think all of that is evidence of shows no evidence of disparate treatment, but is evidence of similar treatment, even if it was rude or demeaning. It's being made to all members of different classes regardless. Unless there are any other questions, that's all I have, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Before I respond to a few of those points, I want to go back and give a better answer to Your Honor's question about the legal issues you have to decide. I had a chance to write it out. The first one is that we ask you to find, as a matter of law, that subjecting customers to hospital to hostile, humiliating, and demeaning treatment because of their race, when the majority is not treated that way, violates the Equal Accommodations Law. And then, secondly, we ask you to find, as a matter of law, on the legal question, proof that people, in this case the African Americans, were subjected to hostile, humiliating, and demeaning treatment because of their race satisfies the second element of the prima facie case of discrimination, which is that there has been a deprivation or denial of service. They said an announcement cannot be a violation, period. That's refuted by their own brief and the Evergreen School case that my friend just told you about. They say in their summary of argument on page 3 of their brief, conduct which is subjectively offensive or rude, but which is not motivated by bias, does not constitute a violation. We don't disagree with that. But that implies, as Evergreen makes clear, that if the conduct is motivated by bias, then it's a violation. And that relates to this fact that if it's 5% of white people in this audience had the same bad treatment as the 95% of African Americans, those 5% wouldn't have a claim because it wasn't motivated by their race. The commission found that bad treatment was given because it was a minority audience, because it was a sea of black faces in the room.
And can you cite to the record where we can read that commission finding?
The
commission finding.
Sure.
I've stopped the clock while you're looking.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me get the actual opinion. Starting in the – it's page 56. It's page A121 of our appendix.
Okay.
Under the heading, evidence of a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for denying complainant access. After referring – he says he made the announcement twice at Halloween because it was a teenage movie, and here's the key language, and he made the announcement at Why Did I Get Married because it was a minority movie, end quote.
Thank you.
So that's the finding of fact on that. On this issue of whether or not hostility can be used for the second or the third element, I should point out that the Callwood case from the federal court in Maryland, which is the source of that test, used it for what Callwood called the third element. But if you read Callwood, you see that in the way Callwood lists the elements, they take the second element, deprivation, the second Delaware element, deprivation of service, and the third Delaware element, that it's probably because of race, and they put the two together and they call that the third element. And so in effect, the Maryland court that is the source of this hostility test used it the same way the commission did. So there was nothing. There was no error. So that if there was the error,
so it was the commission that got the law right,
yeah.
And not the Superior Court.
Yes, Your Honor. And then again, I guess it's clear the Halloween movie was a teenage movie, and that commission found they treated teenagers different. So it's not a fair comparison. It doesn't show that they always treat audiences that way. It's just teenagers and black people.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will also take a brief recess.